in hibernation. The man who opens the door has a sort of glow about him, a bright face, receding hair and soft brown eyes. Koch smiles broadly and shakes my hand. He gestures around himself exuberantly like a ringmaster.
"Welcome to the wall archive," he says.
All along the corridor hang framed colour photocopies of what were once top-secret Stasi maps. They show various parts of the wall in aerial view, with a colour-coded key for the guard towers, mine traps, dogs and tripwires. Black, yellow, red East German pennants are pinned on the wall, and a bodice of the uniform of the leader's elite guard, the Felix Dzerzhinsky Regiment, hangs from hooks, deflated as a scarecrow. More obscure mementos of the regime sit in glass-fronted cupboards. As we walk along the corridor, I think I see a crocheted doily in the national colours. Koch talks as we walk, and by the time we reach his study, he is listing off on his fingers the VIPs who have been to see him and his archive. Behind his desk, a large gold plate bearing the East German hammer and compass shines out from just above head height. The room is lined with framed newspaper articles. The pictures show Koch with his visitors. He looks straight into the camera, clean-featured and moon-faced and beaming. Koch with the Queen of Sweden. Koch with an actor from Star Trek. Koch with Christo, the rap artist. He is more than comfortable with the tiny microphone on my tape recorder. When I ask if I might clip it to his shirt, he takes it from me and wields it like a rock star. His forearms are honey brown and lightly haired. I ask him how he had applied to join the Stasi.
"No, no, no, no. It didn't work like that. You had to be chosen."
Apparently, this was one of the fundamentals of the system. Don't call us, we'll call you.
Who chose you, then?
"Just a moment," he says. "It is hard for you to understand. Without understanding my childhood, you can't see why anyone would want to join the Stasi."
This isn't quite true. I've given a lot of thought to why people would want to join. In a society riven into us and them, an ambitious young person might well want to be one of the group in the know, one of the unmolested. If there was never going to be an end to your country and you could never leave, why wouldn't you opt for a peaceful life and a satisfying career? What interests me is the process of dealing with that decision now that it's all over. Can you rework your past, the grit that rubs in you until it is shiny and smooth as a pearl?
"My upbringing was so..."
He searches for the words.
"So GDR.
His eyebrows move up and down.
"Everything that was GDR positive, that was me."
Koch turns to a large cardboard box on the floor beside his desk.
"My father put me on this track."
He reaches into the box and pulls out a brownish photograph of his father in army uniform, with the expression men in armed services pictures often have, as if they are already elsewhere. Then he goes back to the box and produces a school report. He flashes it at me, and I see the old-style Gothic handwriting. Koch starts to read.
"Hagen was a diligent and orderly pupil."
And then he reads on through the report. We are right back at the beginning of his life. I look at the box, and the box is deep. It seems this afternoon we are going to go through it piece by plastic-wrapped piece.
"You have to understand," he says, "in the context of my father and of the propaganda of the Cold War, the GDR was like a religion. It was something I was brought up to believe in."
He speaks passionately and loudly, although I am sitting close to him and the room is small. I watch him waving his arms and my microphone. He brings out more photographs and more documents, and I hear him say,
"You can see here, after the war we had no mattresses, holes in our socks."
But I am mulling over the idea of the GDR as an article of faith. Communism, at least of the East German variety, was a closed system of belief. It was a universe in a vacuum, complete with its own self-created hells and heavens, its punishments and redemptions meted out right here on Earth.
Many of the punishments were simply for lack of belief, or even suspected lack of belief. Disloyalty was calibrated in the minutest of signs. The antenna turned to receive Western television. The red flag not hung out on May Day. Someone telling an off-color joke about Hanukkah just to stay sane. I remember Sister Eugenia at school, with her tight sausage fingers, explaining the leap of faith that was required before the closed universe of Catholicism would make any sense. Her fingers made the leap, pink and unlikely, as we children drew the fruits of the Holy Spirit. A banana for redemption, as I recall, and all I could think of was a sausage person walking off a cliff top, believing all the time the hand of God would scoop him up. The sense of having someone examine your inner worth, the violence of the idea that it can in fact be measured, was the same. God could see inside you to reckon whether your faith was enough to save you. The Stasi could see inside your life too, only they had a lot more sons on earth to help. The GDR in its 40 years tried strenuously both to create socialist German man and to get the people to believe in him. Socialist German man was to be different from Nazi German man and different from Western capitalist imperialist German man. History was taught as a series of inevitable evolutionary leaps towards communism, from a feudal state through capitalism and then, in the greatest leap forward to date, socialism. The communist nirvana was the world to come. Darwinian diagrams flash into my mind, showing man on a scale of increasing uprightness and lack of body hair, from monkey to Neanderthal to Cro-Magnon to modern. Here now in front of me is socialist man, smooth and keen and very, very verbal. As Koch dips into the carton once more, I wonder whether he ever wished he had been a disruptive and disorderly pupil instead of a diligent and orderly one, whether it would have saved him from carrying his explanatory box through life.
My story comes directly out of my father's story.
Hagen Koch passes me the photograph of his father again, and Heinz Koch looks out from early in the century. He had the same brown eyes as his son, but in a narrower, more doubtful face. Heinz Koch was born in a village in Saxony on the 5th of August 1912, and was brought up as the son of the village tailor. One day, when he was 16 years old, he ran home from school distraught with his report card in his hand. In the space for name was written Koch, Heinz, grandson of the master tailor. Koch pulls a yellowing report from the box.
"This occurred on the 23rd of the 3rd, 1929, he says, shaking the document. On that day, my father learnt of his illegitimacy. His big sister was his mother.
Heinz was stunned by the realization that everyone had lied to him.
You all hid this from me for so long.
Who was his real father? I ask.
I'll get to that, Hagen says. According to the German moral code of that time, illegitimacy was terrible, shameful.
Heinz was immediately ostracized by his friends and left school. He decided to join the army, hoping that a uniform would hide the stigma of his birth. In September 1929, he signed up for a 12-year term of duty. Heinz Koch got more than he bargained for. By the time his term was due to expire in October 1941, he found himself stationed in France as part of the Nazi occupation force and could not be discharged. In May 1945, after Berlin surrendered, Master Sergeant Koch somehow made it back to Dessau, to his wife and two small children. He travelled over a landscape pockmarked with craters, through towns of rubble with pipes and plumbing exposed in the streets. People were crazy with pain and secrets. In the woods and on the roads were refugees, war criminals, rogue bomber groups and allied forces who had started the Cold War between them before the hot one had ended. In Dresden, he thought he smelt rotting flesh. But one week after the war ended, Heinz Koch was home. At the Potsdam Conference, Dessau was given to the Russians. they released him from active duty. Koch is talking, dipping into his document box, talking. Then he leans forward as if to tell me a weighty piece of information. I smell his aftershave. On the 1st of September 1945, he says, the Soviet command issued Heinz with a permission to ride a bicycle.
Why did people need a permit to ride a bike? I ask.
Because they could bring messages, pass on news, Koch cries. There was no other transport. People on bikes could evade checkpoints. They could have secret meetings.
Clearly, the atmosphere of paranoid control had set in early under the Russians. All the same, I've started to worry about the level of detail we are sinking into. I steal a look towards his bottomless box, wondering whether we are descending into the morass for the sake of it, or whether there was some point to the bicycle tale. Then, as he turns away from me to put the document back in his box, he says, "But beforehand, you realize they had to vet his record to check that he wasn't an evil person." Was this the point? Was Koch using the available evidence, in this case a bicycle permit, to construct or confirm a story of his father's innocence during the war? There's clearly a portion of the past here that cannot be pinned down with facts or documents. All that exists is permission to ride a bike. Immediately after the war ended, the Allies divided up their conquered enemy. The English, Americans, and later the French took over the western parts of Germany, and the Russians took the eastern states of Thuringia, Saxony, Saxony-Anhalt, Mecklenburg-West-Pomerania, and Brandenburg. Berlin was divided among the victors in the same way, its western suburbs to the English, Americans, and French, its eastern ones to the USSR. But because the city lay deep in the eastern zone, its western suburbs became an odd island of democratic administration and market economy in a communist landscape. In their zones, the western powers set about catching prominent Nazis and establishing democratic systems of governance, a federated system of states, the division of political, administrative, and judicial power, and guarantees of private property. In 1948, they handed over these institutions to the newly created Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany, together with massive injections of funds from the Americans' Marshall Plan. The Russians ran the eastern parts of Germany directly until the German Democratic Republic was established as a satellite state of the USSR in 1949. Production was nationalized, factories and property turned over to the state. Healthcare, rent, and food were subsidized. One-party rule was established with an all-powerful secret service to back it up. And the Russians, having refused the offer of American capital, plundered East German production for themselves. They stripped factories of plant and equipment, which they sent back to the USSR. At the same time, they required a rhetoric of communist brotherhood from the East Germans, whom they had liberated from fascism. Whatever their personal histories and private allegiances, the people living in this zone had to switch from being, rhetorically at the very least, Nazis one day, to being communists and brothers with their former enemies the next. And almost overnight, the Germans in the eastern states were made, or made themselves, innocent of Nazism. It seemed as if they actually believed that Nazis had come from and returned to the western parts of Germany, and were somehow separate from them, which was in no way true. History was so quickly remade, and so successfully, that it can truly be said that the Easterners did not feel then, and do not feel now, that they were the same Germans as those responsible for Hitler's regime. This sleight of history must rank as one of the most extraordinary innocence manoeuvres of the century. In Dresden once, on a blue bridge over the River Elbe, I saw a plaque commemorating the liberation of the East Germans from their Nazi oppressors by their brothers, the Russians. I looked at it for a long time, a small thing dulled by grime from the air. I wondered whether it had been put there immediately after the Russians came into a vanquished Germany, or whether a certain time had been allowed to elapse before things could begin to be rewritten. To start a new country,
With new values and newly minted socialist citizens, it is necessary to begin at the beginning, with children. School teachers in the eastern regions were immediately dismissed because their job had been to educate children in the values of the Nazi regime. Socialist teachers had to be created. The authorities established 6-month training schemes for people's teachers, who then went into the schools. By February 1946, Heinz Koch, who hadn't finished school himself, was a fully qualified teacher in the village of Lindau, 30 kilometers from Dessau. In October of that year, the first free democratic elections were held in East Germany. In fact, throughout the life of East Germany, elections were regularly held. On the ballot paper, there were representatives of all the major parties, mirror image replicas of the parties that existed in West Germany. There were centre-right Christian Democrats, CDU, Liberal Democrats, later the FDP, and Communists, SED. Election after election for 40 years, the results would be broadcast on television, and always, overwhelmingly, the Communists were voted in. The majority stretched credibility, 98.1%, 95.4%, 97.6%. None of this, though, was evident in 1946. At that time, it was possible, just possible, that somehow a socialist state would emerge which lived up to the democratic of its name. They'd all been through hell on earth. Didn't they deserve heaven? People's dreams had been honed by suffering, whittled into sharp and definite shapes. Heinz Koch founded the Lindau branch of the Liberal Democrats and stood for election as mayor. September there is a month of long sunsets, late light falling through the leaves, still on the trees. Even in this land of rubble and dust, there was room for hope. This was, after all, an election. There were parties, there were candidates, there were local campaigns, and there were polling stations. And there was a ballot paper on which the Communist Party candidate's name was top of the list. It might have been a coincidence, except that next to this candidate's name, Paul Encke, was written not SED candidate, but already mayor. Nevertheless, when the vote came in, it was clear Heinz Koch had won the election. Lindau was a tiny place. The Liberal Democrats got 363 votes, the SED 289, and the CDU 131. People no longer wanted right or left, they wanted middle of the road. But Encke, the communist, Koch said, was chairman of the Electoral Commission. Encke immediately called a meeting in the town hall for the evaluation of the vote. Koch tells me that the hall was full of women, some with children. There were several old men, but there were scarcely any young or middle-aged ones. Encke welcomed them and then addressed the room. "So, where are all your men?" There was a silence, shuffling. "Fallen in war," came one answer. "Missing in action," said another voice. One woman said quietly, "I don't know." Then a voice came from the back of the hall. "My husband is a prisoner of war in Russia." Encke seized his moment. "How many of your men are in POW camps?" he asked. The hands started to go up, at first slowly, but then there were many. "So how long did your husband serve in the forces?" Encke asked a woman sitting near the front. "One year," she said. The answers started to come from all over the room. 5 years, 3 years, 7 years. "And for that they were taken prisoners of war?" "That's the way it happened," said the woman. "Well, I ask you," said Encke, "do you think it right that your men, who served 3 years, 5 years, 7 years in the armed forces, are in prison? When Master Sergeant Koch, on my right here, who served that fascist imperialist army for 16 years, gets off scot-free? Not one single day's punishment?" So,
In this way, Koch says, my father was sentenced to 7 years in a prisoner of war camp.
What? Just like that? I ask.
Koch is agitated now. The Russians came and took him into custody. That was just the way it worked. And the people said that it's right that it should be so. If my husband is sitting it out over there, then so should he.
Between 1945 and 1950, the Russian secret police imprisoned POWs, Nazis, and others like infantryman Heinz Koch, who might have got in their way. They reused the Nazi concentration camps of Sachsenhausen and Buchenwald and other places. And when they were full, they built new prisons or sent people to Russia. It is estimated that some 43,000 of these people died from illness, starvation, or violence after the war. In Lindau, the people helped the victors punish their fellows and called it fair. After nearly a month in custody, on the 22nd of October 1946, Enke came to visit his prisoner. Heinz thought his time was up. Enke started in on an unusual tack.
It's your wife's birthday today, I gather, he said.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be a nice birthday surprise for her if you came home? What would you say to that?
Heinz was confused. He had been stealing himself for transportation.
Is that possible? He asked.
Sure it is. I am mayor, after all, and what I say goes.
There was a pause. Then it became clear.
What are the conditions? Heinz asked.
Relax, comrade, relax. It's simple, really. All you need to do is quit the Liberal Democrats and come over to us. Become a member of the Socialist Unity Party. Just as soon as that happens, I can take you home. In fact, I could take you home today.
Koch is looking at me closely.
What would you do? He asks. How should my father decide?
For the wife and life, of course, I say. Koch is pleased, smiling and nodding and waving the mic.
So, he says, on his wife's birthday, Heinz changed parties and went home.
In this way, the Lindau Communist Party annihilated its opposition and at the same time installed one of their own as the local primary school teacher, under threat of deportation to a POW camp. They had him where they could keep an eye on him. There was only one school, and the children of all the party members were there. Later that same year, Hagen started school. Heinz taught all his pupils the doctrine of communism, including his little boy. He found himself educating good socialist citizens for a regime that had tried to ruin his family and his life.
In late 1946, the communists founded the Junge Pioniere, a youth organization designed to instill in young children a love of Marx and country. For the older ones, the Free German Youth was established. The scheme mirrored exactly the Nazis' Pimpfer for small children and the Hitler Youth for adolescents. People joked that the Free German Youth and the Hitler Youth were so similar that only the color of the neckerchiefs distinguished them. In both, there were meetings, torches, oaths of allegiance, and a confirmation ceremony for 13-year-olds, complete with candles and prayer-like incantations. All small children were required to join the Pioniere, but this came too soon for the villagers of Lindau. They balked at seeing their children once more in line and marching, and refused to put them in uniform again for the powers that be. Heinz Koch was arrested and taken into custody. Enke said,
why should the other children join up if the teacher's own son does not?
It was necessary for Heinz Koch to set an example through his son. He was released and given one more chance to show why he should not be deported. Koch turns to his box and pulls out a small blue scarf.
So, as a result, on the 13th of December 1946, I was the first child to wear this kerchief around my neck.
This is how Hagen Koch became a Musterknabe, a poster boy for the new regime. My gaze has wandered to the wall behind him. Next to the gold plate hangs a girly calendar displaying a naked woman's torso in a forest. The photographer has cut off her head and her legs below the knee. The caption reads, "Wilderness Area." Hagen Koch turns back to his box, his collection of strange talismans from a bygone world. "Let me show you this beetle," he says, pulling out a poster. He unrolls it. "Stop the American Beetle," is written in large capitals across the top. Below, there's a drawing of a child holding a magnifying glass to the ground. Under it is a beetle with a human face and big human teeth. The beetle wears a jacket in the colors of the American flag, and its face is the face of President Truman. "These were all over our school," he says, and explains why. In 1948, the Russians decided they had had enough of the small island of capitalist imperialism that was West Berlin. It seethed with the spies of enemy countries. It was a toehold for the Allies on socialist soil. In a modern siege, Stalin's forces cut off land supply routes through East Germany to West Berlin. On the night of the 24th of June 1948, they switched off the eastern power plant that supplied the city. The West Berliners were to be starved out in the dark. But the Allies would not give up the 2 million West Berliners. For almost a year, from June 1948 to October 1949, they kept the city alive by plane. At that time, American and British planes made some 277,728 flights through Soviet airspace to drop bundles of food, clothing, cigarettes, medicine, fuel, and equipment, including components for a new power station, to the people of West Berlin. In the West, the aircraft came to be known as the Rosinen Bomber, or Raisin Bombers, because they brought food. But in the East, Koch and his classmates were told the enemy plane sprayed potato beetles over East German crops as they flew over, in order to spoil the harvest. Lindau was virtually under the flight path. "The planes flew day and night," Koch says. "This is how they gave us a picture of the enemy. In a place where people get no news from outside, they have nothing else to believe." Why was it credible that the Americans would do this? I ask. It seemed improbable that a nuclear superpower would be loading up planes full of live beetles on leaves and setting out across the Atlantic with them. "Because they had just bombed Dresden flat," he cried. "That beautiful center of German culture. Senselessly. And they even dropped 2 atom bombs on Japan. They were clearly, truly evil. What more proof do you need?" Bombs, atomic weapons, and now a biblical pestilence. "I am telling you how propaganda works," he continues. "That is how I grew up." At this time, there was still rationing. Sugar was scarce and boiled sweets were a luxury. But there was an incentive scheme for the children. For every beetle we collected, we could redeem a penny. For a larva, a halfpenny. And for every 100, we got 10 ration cards for sugar. So we children went into the fields every spare minute we had, collecting beetles and larvae, beetles and larvae. We handed them in, and we got more sweets than we could eat. In Koch's mind, the sweet taste of reward is connected with foiling the American plot to spoil the potato crop and starve his people. This story of insects and sweets and the making of an enemy is the story of the making of a patriot. Chapter 17. Drawing the Line. So it was that I came on the 5th of April 1960 to the Ministry of State Security. Hagen Koch nearly swallows the words. 4 days later, he says, this photo was taken. The photo shows a young man in his grey Stasi uniform, spruced and tense behind a huge lectern. Koch was giving his maiden speech, "Why I want to protect and defend my homeland." He took the oath,
By order of the Workers' and Farmers' State, I promise, if necessary, to lay down my life, to protect against the enemy, obediently and everywhere.
All the top brass were there. Milko was there. Afterwards, Koch stood in a loose group with his commandant. The other recruits were pretending to relax and trying to be noticed at the same time. Suddenly, Koch felt all eyes on him and a hand on his shoulder. He turned around. It was Milka.
"What is your training, young man?"
"Technical draftsman."
Milka addressed Koch's commandant.
"I want you to look after this one. His career. This is the kind we need."
"And so," Koch says, "that is how I was lifted out from the great grey mass."
He was immediately made director of the drafting office for cartographics and topography.
"I didn't have a clue," he tells me. "My training was as a technical draftsman for machines. I knew nothing about maps."
In the summer of 1960, shortly after joining the Stasi, Koch fell in love with a girl from Berlin. She hadn't been in the Pioniere or the Free German Youth, and she certainly wasn't in the party, but she wasn't radical either. Koch smiles and sort of half winks.
"I chose my wife by her outside, not her political convictions."
I find myself looking away, and the girly calendar catches my eye. It can't meet my gaze because its head is cut off. I look at its map of Tasmania in the forest. The Stasi knew everything. Koch's boss called him in and told him,
"That girl is inappropriate. We have plans for you, and that little one, she is GDR negative."
For their part, her parents were horrified. He was one of them. As soon as she turned 18, they eloped. It was the 21st of July, 1961. Koch turns around and flicks a hand at the calendar.
"You noticed that, did you?"
he chuckles.
"Hmm. Do you know what it is?"
"What do you mean?" I ask.
"That is the calendar for the border troops of the GDR," he said. "Do you know what is special about it?"
"No."
"That calendar was printed in mid-1990, after the wall came down. It was printed because even in that late stage, people here could not believe that the nation would simply cease to exist. Despite all the evidence, they thought the GDR would go on as an independent country, with an army and a border guard of its own, and that border guard would need its own girly calendar. When the wall was built in 1961, I thought it was something we had to do because they were robbing us blind," Koch says. "The GDR was compelled to protect itself from the swindlers and parasites and black marketeers of the West."
Because of subsidization, prices were lower in the East, but so were wages.
"Before there was a wall," he says, "people thought, why should I work in the East when I could earn more in the West? So they went across to them each day and offered them their labor when we so badly needed it here to rebuild. And then, at the checkpoints on their way home, they'd change their West marks for Eastern ones at a rate of 5 to 1. Can you imagine?"
He says this as if rates of exchange were some kind of money voodoo.
"They'd come back here able to buy up everything of ours. Not only that, but they'd buy up for their friends in the West as well. In the mornings we used to see these people on their way to work with rucksacks full of our bread, our butter, our milk, eggs and meat." Something had to be done to stop people fleeing through this mouse hole in the GDR.
As well as leaving to work in the Western sector each day, hundreds and later thousands of refugees started leaving the Eastern sector for good. By 1961, about 2,000 people were leaving the East each day through West Berlin. Koch says his thinking was orthodox for the time.
These people were shirking the hard work that had to be done here in order to build a better future for themselves. They wanted to enjoy their lives right here, right now. It was as if that were a moral failure, a religious falling off the branch. Who are these people who will reap where they have not sown? The GDR was hemorrhaging. And it wasn't just the ordinary workers who were leaving. It was the doctors, the engineers, the educated people. The GDR had paid for their education, and then they allowed themselves to be seduced by the lure of the West. So, according to Koch, Ulbricht, the head of state, decided he needed to build an anti-fascist protective measure. I have always been fond of this term, which has something of the prophylactic about it, protecting Easterners from the Western disease of shallow materialism. It obeys all the logic of locking up free people to keep them safe from criminals. On the night of Sunday, the 12th of August, 1961, the Eastern German Army rolled out barbed wire along the streets bordering the Eastern Sector and stationed sentries at regular intervals. At daylight, people woke to find themselves cut off from relatives, from work, from school. Some made a dash through the wire. Others, who lived in apartments overlooking the borderline, started to jump from the windows into blankets held out by Westerners on the footpath below. Then the troops made residents brick up their own windows. They started with the lower floors, forcing people to jump from higher and higher windows. Koch was called to the garrison on the 13th of August, the day the wall went up. It was a state of emergency, and they were to stay on alert. 2 days later, I was called in to the commandant. He looked at my boots and pronounced them too shoddy for the mission. He ordered me to accompany a group, including Honecker, along where they had rolled out all the barbed wire, where the wall was starting to be. And he ordered me to get new boots. It was an ordinary summer day. When we got to where Checkpoint Charlie was to be, there were crowds of protesters on the western side shouting at us. I had my left leg in the east, my right leg in the west, and I drew my white line across the street. I concentrated on the line and not on what was happening around me. I thought to myself that those in the west were enemies, looters, and profiteers. Koch then walked with Honecker and the others the length of the border through the city, nearly 50 kilometres. I'm surprised he doesn't have more to say about this day, which one might consider the beginning of his life's obsession. "I was only 21 years old, he says. "I just concentrated on my job of drawing the line." Then he adds, "The next day I could hardly stand. You know how it is with new boots." He leans forward. "People ask me why I didn't cross the line when I was drawing it along the streets. Why didn't I just step over to the west and keep on walking? Because I was in love. I'd been married 3 weeks, so of course I went back to my young wife. It's only natural. Just like my father, he went back to his wife and I went back to mine." But his father went back to his family under threat of deportation to a POW camp. Koch didn't need to be threatened. Trained by his father, he had become socialist man. Koch says he is the only person alive who can represent, in his documents and photocopies and photographs, the wall from the eastern side. Perhaps this is because most people on that side want to forget it. In fact, it seems now most people on both sides want to pretend it was never there. The wall has been erased so quickly that there is hardly a trace of it in the streets. Only a small part of the most colourful section remains, like a gaudy headstone. In 1966, Heinz Koch traced his biological father, who lived in Holland. The grandfather came to the GDR on a day visa to meet his son. He came as an ordinary tourist. "And because I was with the Stasi," Hagen says, "my dad, aged 54, was thrown out of his job." "Because he was a close relative to you, he was not allowed to have Westkontakte." "Because I hadn't told them about the visit." The Stasi had to know
everything about the extended families of everyone, but most particularly about their own. That was when my father first told me about his illegitimacy, about running for mayor, and about the threats to him if he didn't make me into a good socialist. I wondered what it would feel like to find out that you had been brought up by your parents as a paragon of a regime they did not believe in. Koch said to his father, "Dad, if that's the way it is, I've had it. I want out." He thought, "If my working here is a reason my father can't meet with his father, I don't want to be here anymore." "I handed in my letter of resignation," he says. The same day, he was arrested and put into a cell. Criminal charges were laid. They were preparation and reproduction of pornographic material. "What?" He enjoys my surprise and reaches once more into his box. He pulls out a stapled, handmade pamphlet. It has Romeo Purple handwriting on it and cartoon pictures. Koch made a dozen copies of the booklet to celebrate a friend's wedding. In traditional German style, he sent up the groom, the bride, and the in-laws. It showed caricatures of them, fully clothed, with speech balloons, and was very far from being pornography. It was, however, illegal. In this country, any kind of printing was forbidden unless authorized. The Stasi had even developed a science of connecting individual typewriters to the print they made, as if to fingerprint thought. Koch had used the machines at his office. They kept him in the cell for 2 nights and didn't tell his wife where he was. He was permitted no outside contact, no lawyer, no phone calls. Standard procedure. On the third day, the Stasi and the DA searched his apartment for more pornographic material as evidence. They didn't find any. They questioned Mrs. Koch, who experienced a strange mixture of relief and focused terror. "So that's where he is." "They asked her," Koch's voice goes soft with distaste, "they asked her about our sex life. They told her that if there was something wrong in that department, they would understand, and it might account for why your husband has taken up as a pornographer." "No, no," she started to cry. "She said there was nothing wrong." The DA said, "Well then, in that case, Frau Koch, I put it to you that your husband would only have prepared this pornography."
"What pornography?"
She was desperate. "This pornography," he ignored her, "at your instigation." The only sound was of the other man rifling through the apartment. "It seems you have nothing to say," he went on. "Let me ask you something. Is there anyone who could look after your little boy for the next 5 years or so?"
"What? Why?"
"Because I'm afraid, Frau Koch, that as the instigator of a pornographic scheme, the penalties for you are severe." She started to cry.
"I don't understand. What do you want from us? What do you want from me? Don't take my child from me, please."
"Frau Koch," the DA said, "the way I see it, the only chance for you would be if you credibly, and I mean credibly, distance yourself from your husband and what he has done. Only then would it be possible for me to recommend lenience to the judge in your case."
"What do you mean? What is it you want me to do?"
"It's quite simple," he said, opening his briefcase. "All you need to do is sign this application for divorce."
I feel a mild physical shock.
Koch says an application for divorce was put on the table, and it was already filled out with each of their names in full, their dates of birth, identity numbers, and address.
"She signed it," he says quietly. "She signed it out of fear they'd take the child away. Then they came to me in prison with this thing."
He is disgusted again, even in the telling. "They said,
'Have a look at this here. It would appear your wife wants nothing more to do with you.'"
Koch lowers his voice. "At that moment, my world broke apart."
3 days later, my party secretary came to see me in the lock-up. He was a man in his 50s with yellow hair and a red face. He said, "Koch, my friend, I haven't been able to sleep for 3 nights. For God's sake, what is going on here? You were always so punctual and reliable, so diligent and orderly. We've got to get you out of this mess."
He walked up and down in the cell. "The thing is, if you leave, knowledge leaves with you. Operational knowledge goes with you. And knowledge must stay. Either you understand you have made an error in thinking by trying to resign, or you will be locked up for 4.5 years so that your knowledge stays here anyway." He spreads his hands in a gesture of sympathy. "You know, Koch, you've really only got one chance left. You have to take back your resignation, and as proof that you have understood the error in thinking you have made, you will renew your pledge to lifelong service." He put 2 documents on the table, already filled out. A retraction and another pledge. "Oh, and what's this I hear about your wife leaving you? Terrible! You know, it's times like these that we, the party, we will stick by you, comrade."
"Did you believe your wife would leave you?" I ask Koch.
"I had it in writing," he shouts. "I had it in writing."
"Yes, but did you believe it?"
"I had it in writing."
This is a man who believes in documents.
"Oh, and another thing," he says. "They said to me, when you've got rid of this wife, this negative influence, then you can probably be promoted." I was sitting in the prison. There was no one to talk it over with. So I said, "Can I go into the cultural division then?" And he said, "Yes."
I wonder how it worked inside the Stasi. Who thought up these blackmail schemes? Did they send them up the line for approval? Did pieces of paper come back initialed and stamped approved? The ruining of a marriage, the destruction of a career, the imprisonment of a wife, the abandonment of a child. Did they circulate internal updates? 5 new and different ways to break a heart? When Koch came out of the lockup, he was deaf to everything but his distress. It clearly upsets him to be telling me.
"I wanted nothing more to do with that woman," he says. "She thinks she can just leave me in the lurch like that and then come back and be my wife?" "We were divorced. Our boy Frank was 5, and he went to live with her."
I try to think myself into his place. I think what I would most want to hear would be an explanation from my beloved that it was all a terrible mistake. I ask him why he didn't ask.
"Because I wouldn't hear it! I wouldn't hear it!"
he shouts, imitating how he cut off his wife.
"How dare you tell me to listen after what you've done?"
But he did listen to his son. Months later, taking Frank for an ice cream, the story came out. Frank had been in the apartment and heard the officers threaten to take him away. Koch spoke with his ex-wife. 1 year after his imprisonment, and 6 months after their divorce, Mr. and Mrs. Koch remarried. The Stasi subjected him to disciplinary proceedings on account of inconstancy, and in their files attributed the remarriage to the repeated negative influence of Frau Koch. Chapter 18. The Plate. In 1985, Heinz Koch died. His sister, who lived in Hamburg, West Germany, received permission to attend the funeral. Because she was coming, Hagen was forbidden to attend. This was more than he could take. He applied to leave his regiment. He would have liked this to be a final small defiance, a little signal of up yours at a time when no harm could come to his father, and he didn't have much to lose. But it was merely a transfer out of the Stasi and into the regular army, under condition of maintaining Stasi secrecy. They were going to let him leave, and it made him feel empty. He sat in his office. There are strange moments where the present already belongs to your past. Your last day at work, for instance,
when problems and politics there become a tale told in the third person. Koch looked around his office as if it belonged to someone else. Everything in the room was to stay there. His replacement would come in and no one would know the difference. He was interchangeable with any other uniform and bad crew cut. It made him angry to think he would leave no mark here, and it made him angrier still that, even if he had his time again, he suspected he wouldn't have had the guts. The wall opposite him had an unhealthy sheen of old paint, and so did the plate pinned on it. It was an award for cultural work by his unit, third place. It shone like gold, but it was made of plastic, covered in metallic paint like a cheap toy. It was not something he could say he himself had won. Nevertheless, Koch closed his office door, got up on his chair, and slid the plate from its hooks. He was surprised how light it was. His briefcase wouldn't close over it, so he took off his vest, draped it over the bag, and held the handles together. He walked out of his office, said goodbye to the assistant, and didn't come back. "My little private revenge," he says. "That plate," he looks straight at me, "was all I had the courage for." 3 weeks later, there was a knock at his apartment door. The head of Koch's old Stasi section stood in the passageway. He was still being collegial. "The plate is gone." "What?" "You heard me, comrade. The plate is gone. The commandant wants the plate back." "What do you know?" Koch said to him, leaning on the open door. "As soon as I'm gone, the whole place falls apart. As long as I sat in that chair, that plate hung on the wall." "Come on, Koch. It can't have just disappeared. At the Ministry for State Security, nothing just disappears." "I'm afraid I can't help you." Koch closed the door. The commandant established a working group on plate reprocurement. Koch was summoned back to headquarters for interviews and required to give a statement. He hid the plate in his kitchen. A short time later, they sent in bigger guns. The district attorney came by.
"Where's this plate?"
"I don't know."
"I'll need a sworn affidavit to that effect."
"Fine by me." Nothing further happened. 1989 came, the wall came down, and Koch started to build up his archive. He retrieved the plate from behind the sink pipe and pinned it up in his study. Now it was a real trophy. In 1993, a television crew came to interview him. Germany was reunited, and East Germany was a place in the past. The interviewer went through his questions before they started to shoot, so Koch would be prepared. But he was already prepared, because they were all the usual questions. "Do you regret your time with the Stasi? What is your connection to the wall? Is that what made you establish this wall archive?" Koch could see the strapline already. "Stasi man keeps wall alive at home." He thought how easy it is for an interviewer to assume moral superiority by virtue of the fact he gets to ask the questions. Even in this new Germany, these weren't really questions about how the regime possessed people, and his weren't really answers. Koch would dutifully tell the story of his upbringing. The interviewer was ready to roll and had started the cue in when the cameraman called, "Stop!" The crew relaxed their shoulders. "What's up?" asked the interviewer.
"I need that plate down. It's reflecting in my lens."
The interviewer motioned for an offsider to step around Koch and take it down, but Koch stood up. "He tells it to me as a moment of glory."
No, he said.
The room fell silent.
"I don't care what you want from me," he continued slowly. "I will do whatever you ask. I will turn everything in this apartment upside down. I will sing the national anthem if you want, but that plate stays there."
The interviewer was puzzled. Here was a man who had worked for the firm for 25 years and who now had the gall to try and make a living talking about it. A shameless moral gymnast re-performing his capitulations for the camera. And he was drawing the line at a plate? Koch remained standing. "That plate," he said again, "stays there."
"Okay, okay."
Koch sat down. The interviewer knew when to say nothing. Koch started to tell the whole story. His theft, the establishment of the working group on plate reprocurement, the interviews and statements, the threats and fuss. Koch said he didn't realize that the camera was rolling. The way he tells it, he didn't mind that it was. The program was made and broadcast. Several days later, the doorbell rang at Koch's apartment. Two men showed their wallet passes. Truhand. This was the body set up after the regime collapsed to oversee the fire sale of East German state-owned enterprises to the private sector.
"Herr Koch, we've come for the plate," said one of them.
What? This was unified Germany, westernized and democratic Germany, and still someone wanted that plate.
"Pursuant to the Treaty of Reunification between the Federal Republic of Germany and the former German Democratic Republic, all property belonging to the latter is vested in the former. That plate was rightfully property of the GDR and is now property of the Federal Republic of Germany. We are charged with its collection."
"Get out!"
"We are willing to turn a blind eye to the manner in which that plate came into your possession, Herr Koch, provided you return it immediately."
Koch was incensed.
"Get out of my apartment! If you want the plate, go get a court order for it. Without an order, you're not coming in. No one takes the plate."
So it came in the mail. Criminal proceedings were issued against him. The indictment charged him with theft of GDR property. Still, Koch did nothing. Not long afterwards, there was another knock at the door. It was the same men again.
"Excuse us, Herr Koch. I am pleased to inform you that the allegation of theft has been withdrawn."
"Mm-hmm."
"In the first place, on account of triviality. The plate was worth only 16 Eastern marks. In the second place, because of the statute of limitations for such crimes. The allegations concerned an act which took place 8 years ago and are therefore barred."
Koch looks at me closely.
"However," the officer said, "new proceedings have been issued against you."
"Oh?
For perjury."
"Get out."
The official put his foot in the door.
"I'm afraid, Herr Koch, that it is alleged that on the 14th of June, 1985, you swore in an affidavit to the Ministry of State Security of the former German Democratic Republic that you did not know the whereabouts of the plate in question. That is an offence against the law then in force in the GDR, and it is the responsibility of the new Germany to ensure prosecution of crimes which occurred in the former GDR."
I'm laughing by now. Koch goes on.
"I said, bravo, terrific, well done. Can't you people make up your minds? Do you want to see me punished because I worked for the firm, or do you want to see me punished because I worked against the firm? What is it exactly you want?"
He's laughing now, too. This is his moment. The man who drew the line and who sat on the fence pulls some righteousness from the post-war rubble. "Did the trial come about?" I ask him.
"No.
But all these allegations did quite a bit of damage. My wife lost her job because of them. The rumours were pretty bad, and they took on a life of their own. You know, Koch is a thief, a liar, a perjurer." He pauses and leans towards me. I can smell him again, warm and piney. He says,
"You know, though, it was worth it. All the courage I had is in that plate. The whole shitty little skerrick of it. That's all I had. That plate," he says, pointing behind him, "stays there."
Beep.
"Hi, Miriam, it's Anna." I'm keeping this upbeat. "Just thought I'd call to say hello. I'd love to catch up. I've been having some odd adventures in your old country. Curiouser and curiouser. I've a lot to tell. Anyway, I'll call, or you can reach me. I leave my number. See you." Herr Koch gave me Stasi diagrams and photographs of the border installation at Bonhomerstrasse.
"Top secret," he cried gleefully,
as he made copies of them on the machine in his hallway. A day or two later, I have them rolled in my pocket as I walk from my apartment to where Miriam climbed over. I also have the sketch she drew. The place where she was caught is marked with a gash of blue ink. I want to see what it looked like to her. I want to place these pictures over what's there now, as if to bring the past into some kind of focus. It is muggy today. Everyone has been burning their heaters without pause for weeks, and the clouds are low and tinted with coal dust. I take breaths of this orange sky as I walk. The first thing I reach is the garden colony. A path leads through the plots, each one fenced off from its neighbour with cyclone mesh. There are small huts on them for garden tools and seeds, for barbecue grills and folding chairs and ladders. There are a few larger trees, but mostly there is just sodden black earth arranged in rectangles, waiting for a lick of sun to bring up vegetables and flowers. These are squared-off places for contained fantasies. In one plot, I find Snow White and her dwarves, two fawns and two portly gnomes all cohabiting peacefully with an almost life-sized sow and her three fat piglets. Between the garden plots and where the wall was, there's a wider stretch of grass and then an embankment. I climb up to another cyclone fence and look through at the mess of railway lines and small walls. This fence is old and rusted. I wonder whether it was the same one Miriam climbed. To my left is the bridge, where she thought the guards were watching her, and where, 20 years later, 10,000 people thronged on a single night to get through to the west. I hold up a black-and-white photograph with one hand and the Stasi diagram with the other. Technical improvements on the national border to Berlin, west. I want to see where the second fence, the sand strip, the tank traps, the guard towers, the light pylons, the dog run and the tripwires were. They are all gone. Then I remember that they were in front of the railway lines. They must have been in the stretch of grass I walked over between the garden plots and where I am now standing. I take out Miriam's sketch. It is a few lines on a page for walls, for the kink in the wall where she stopped to breathe and lock eyes with the dog, for the tripwire where she was caught. My hands are blue as I hold the paper up to the rusted diamonds of wire. I wonder if I'm in the right place. Miriam said the bridge was about 150 meters away from where she crossed. I moved my right till I think I'm in the same spot. Two trains cross. The rhythm of their wheels fuses and then parts again. When they are gone, I peer at the railway lines. There are at least six of them, shunting trains from north to south and back. Then there's an earth-retaining wall, not particularly high, but the ground behind it is at another level. Is this where she climbed? I look for a kink, and I find one. Was that where she crouched? It starts to get dark. The street lights on the bridge glow their sick yellow light. I roll up the photo and the diagram and Miriam's drawing and crumple them into my pocket. I put my fingers through the wire and hang on to the fence for a while. Chapter 19. Klaus. Can I come over?
What for?
I think I've woken him up. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. A visit, Klaus. I need to get out of the house. What I need, in fact, is becoming a habit, an act of hops and malt chemistry. I need to feel good temporarily about plates and walls, old men and rules, bakeries and rug work, and corridor after corridor of rooms sealed with secret purpose. I need to see a survivor.
Okay, he says. Not now, though. Later.
All right. See you later, then. We're on to our third beer, and it's only 6 p.m. Klaus's tremor has stopped, and he's changed out of the dressing gown he was in when I arrived to black jeans and a black windcheater. His hair is motley on his head and motley in his beard. He has a crumpled face with brown teeth and squinty, smiley eyes. His hands are large and purplish, the hands of a dedicated smoker. He is grumpy and friendly at the same time, just warming up. Like most people, I know a little about his life, but I wouldn't mind hearing it from him, a night-time story. He grumbles at first. What self-respecting icon needs to say how they got that way? But we crack open more cans and he obliges me, relaxing into it. He sits soft-bodied in the chair, as if the cleaners have been taken out of him. He assumes the shape of the furniture. We face a coffee table with matches and tins on it, and ashtrays already full of butts and papers and clumps of tobacco like hair. Behind that, there's a massive television set with stereo speakers. This room is also Klaus's bedroom and office. There's a mattress on the mezzanine to my left, and underneath it a fax machine, a computer, and synthesizer. The walls are lined with photographs and posters, and Klaus's dark oil paintings. The one nearest my eyeline has a series of pictures etched into it. It's the evolution of the breast, from pointy to pendulous. This room is Klaus's life. It's the inside of his head. The early photographs show Klaus Jentsch before he took his mother's maiden name as a stage name. A clean-cut young man in 1958, wearing a suit and pencil tie, looking down modestly at his double bass. They track his development into a long-haired star with a sheepskin coat and a bass guitar. The most recent ones are tour posters. A group of six middle-aged men in an assortment of headbands, beards and sunglasses, with raised fists and sweat on their chests. Klaus, though, seems to have become, if anything, more himself. No headband, no glasses, just jeans and a T-shirt and a guitar. Klaus Rempft is the bad boy of East German rock and roll. The Klaus Rempft combo became the wildest and the most popular rock band in the GDR. Klaus started off playing Chuck Berry and Bill Haley covers in the 50s, and then moved on in the 60s to the Animals, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and in the 70s to Steppenwolf, Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. Often these records were banned outright, so Klaus and his friends listened illegally to Western RIAS radio and recorded the songs on huge tape decks in order to work out the music. They sang, screaming, "I can't get no satisfaction." I'm amazed that the authorities let them get away with the Stones' Satisfaction, a song which, if it became an anthem for desire of all kinds in the West, was bound to be a rallying cry against the whole system in the East. Did they know what it meant, I ask? "We didn't know what it meant," Klaus laughs, prodding down tobacco and small burnt beads of hash into a white-handled pipe. His laugh is deep and innocent. He is a man with the gift of pleasure. His smile heats the room. Over time, the Klaus Rempft combo played more and more of their own songs, and when Gerulf Panache joined in 1969, the lyrics suggested rebellion, poignancy and hope, or, as one magazine put it, soul, frailty and pain. In the ersatz world of the Lipsy, Rempft was something authentic and unauthorized. But there was only one record company, Amiga, and Klaus says that the lyrics to every one of their songs were changed before they could be recorded. Rempft took, he says, the holy things of the GDR, the army and the wall, and sang about them, because they wanted to scratch the GDR at its marrow. Klaus gets up from the chair, his movements quick as a cat, although maybe I'm starting to see things slower. I'm trying to think what it would mean to have all your experience of rock music brought to you live, but second-hand, wondering, did Jagger, Plant and Daltrey know of their doppelgangers in the East? But as soon as Klaus puts the music on, I am a believer. There is something about good rock that defies thought. It is pure and base at the same time, and it moves you inside in ways you can't say. The singer, Christian Kuno Kunert, was trained in a church choir in Leipzig, and his voice hits you like the truth. He sings their famous Die Ketten werden knapper, The Chains Are Getting Tighter, and The Ballad of Little Otto, who longed to reach his brother in the West. Klaus sits down again and puffs happily. When the songs are over, he keeps talking. Renf was not permitted to play in towns, so they played to enormous crowds which came out to the villages.
Woodstock every day, he grins.
You know, for us, the GDR wasn't just Stasi, Stasi, Stasi. It was sex and drugs and rock and roll, he says in English.
By drugs, he means alcohol and cigarettes, which were all the drugs they had, but they made the most of them.
I mean, we really lived, he says, and it was fun.
Some towns we went to, the main street would have its buildings painted only halfway up. The top part would be bare grey concrete.
He looks at me as if he has posed a riddle, which he has.
It was because when Honecker came through, that was the level he could see to from the back seat of the limousine. They didn't have enough paint to go further up.
I know about this, and about the butcher's shops full of small goods for the drive-by, which would vanish again after Honecker or other officials had been through. Klaus finds all this hysterically funny. Then he says,
This society, it was built on lies, lie after lie after lie.
The emperor has no clothes. The buildings are half naked.
Renf might have started off with borrowed Western rock songs, but there were so many lies that singing the